Welcome to Politics and Reality Radio. I'm Joshua Holland. This week we're going to do something a bit unusual.
And now for something completely different.
I recorded a debate for Seattle Public Radio with Kashama Sawant, Seattle's great progressive city councilor. If you're not familiar with Sawant, she's a rock star in the progressive movement who's widely credited with spearheading the successful fight for a $15 minimum wage in Seattle. She's great, but unfortunately, she's endorsing Jill Stein for president. Anyway, the good folks who produce On the Record for KUOW, the public radio station in Puget Sound, were gracious enough to let us present the debate to listeners of this show. They're going to edit it way down, but we're going to give you almost the whole thing. We just made a nip and a tuck here and there for length. It was otherwise, we would have gone over by a couple minutes. So that will be the first half or so of today's show. Now, a central point of contention is that Kashama does not accept what I think is an indisputable fact that the Democratic Party has moved significantly to the left since the 1990s, really since the 2000 election and the growth of the new progressive movement. I think that is... It's kind of an insult to all the people who have worked to marginalize the DLC type centrist, you know, pro-business wing of the Democratic Party. Now, the studio engineer said that Kashama spoke for about 70% of the time, so I feel comfortable. I feel like it's not untoward to invite Caitlin Sweeney from the Progressive Change Campaign Committee to the second segment, and that's what they do. This is a group that that's all they do, is they push Democrats to the left. And she's going to talk about that very question. We're going to recap a little bit about the third debate and what the third debate tells us about this larger movement of the center of the Democratic Party. It should be a good show. Stay tuned. Welcome back to the show. This is Politics and Reality Radio, and I'm Joshua Holland. The audio we're about to hear comes courtesy of KUOW Radio in Seattle. It's a debate between myself and Kashama Sawant about the value of voting for the Green Party's presidential candidate, Jill Stein. The moderator asking the questions is Bill Ratke, who hosts The Record, which is on Monday through Thursday at noon local time. And we just jump right in, so enjoy.
Joshua, you wrote that you support a lot of the Green Party platform, and you voted for the Green Party's presidential candidate in 2004. So why do you say it's a waste to vote for Jill Stein?
Well, I think that much of the argument over the Green Party is really a referendum on the Democratic Party. And I dabbled in Green Party politics, and what I found in my own experience was that there was a lot of disorganization. There was a lot of infighting. It's an ineffective party, and it's an ineffective party because it's taken a strategy of devoting a lot of its resources to presidential elections, quixotic runs for president. Whereas I think that if you're going to be an effective third party, the way to do it is to build from the bottom up, run for local offices. I would point to how much Kashama Sawant has accomplished in the city council in Seattle. The Green Party has their office holders at the local level has declined by 25% since 2003. So I think that they're going in the opposite direction by putting all of their resources into, well, putting an overwhelming share of their resources into getting on the ballot for these presidential campaigns.
City Council Member Sawant, so Joshua is saying that the Green Party is the wrong vessel, ineffective, quixotic. What do you say? You're supporting a vote for Jill Stein.
I am, but if you allow me, I wanted to just go back to the context in which we are talking about this, because without that, it's not easy to explain what the logic is. So just starting from the first basis, let's make sure that we have no doubt or dispute about the fact that Trump is a monster. He's a racist. He's a bigot. He's an anti-immigrant person. And as a socialist, as an immigrant of color myself, and as somebody who is an elected representative for working people, for the marginalized, I find his whole agenda absolutely stomach-turning. I think what we need to talk about is the more astounding fact that until about less than 2 weeks ago, this race was a competitive race. That's what people need to be grappling with, especially if we as analysts are supposed to provide some guidance, some understanding of what's going on. And I think on the face of it, that fact should be unfathomable, that such a horrible person like Trump was running in a competitive race. That has to mean something. And I think that that is explained by the widespread disgust of American people, regular people. I'm just talking about regular people who go to work, young people who are going to school, to college. There is a widespread disgust and anger at the corporate domination of politics. And what they've seen is decade after decade, our interests, the interests of working people, the interests of Black people, women, have been under steady decline because of this logic that in order to prevent the absolute worst of the right wing, we have to settle for something really, really bad, which is corporate democratic agenda.
Joshua is saying that the wrong solution is the Green Party because yes, they're ineffective. What do you say?
Well, I would say that this is not about the Green Party. In my mind, and in the minds of Socialist Alternative, my activist organization that I work with, who supported Bernie in the primary, who then urged Bernie Sanders to run as an independent through November. And then because he failed to do that, we have endorsed Jill Stein. For us, this is not about the Green Party. And for the vast majority of people who are looking for a change, this is not about the Green Party. That's
but
not
Kishama,
an accurate representation
we're debating
of
the Green
people.
Party.
No, we're debating the
yes,
question
we are.
Of...
Yes, we wrote in The Nation about the Green Party. We're debating the Green Party. Look,
no,
the reason that Donald Trump had a competitive race for quite a while is not hard to understand. He was nominated to a major party by about 5% of the electorate. 11% of eligible voters participated in the Republican primaries. The majority of them voted for somebody else. These 5%, or give or take a few, nominated him to the major party. And then most voters, the vast majority of Americans, vote according to their traditional partisanship, their long-held partisanship. For the most part, we adopt...
I think if we are not talking about the vast majority of America, which is tens of millions of people who, even though they will vote for Clinton, I totally understand that, and I want Trump to be defeated, we if we have this platform, I think we are really not using it in an effective manner if we are going to insist on being out of touch with the reality all across America, which is a rejection. What's happening this year is not about the Green Party. What's
well,
happening
then why not
this year
vote for there? There's a Socialist Workers Party on the ballot. There's Socialism and Liberation Party. Why not vote for them?
I'm glad you asked that question, Bill, because that's an important one, understanding, because this is a question of strategy. It is not a question of a fetish about any party. It's a question of strategy. For me, I'm grounded in practical realities about working people, about Black people. How do we solve the question of racism, misogyny, sexual violence, about the fact that we have such a decline in workplace rights, the power of unions, and the fact that young people have only low-wage jobs and student debt, mounting student debt to look forward to? I mean, these are practical questions. So it begs the question of strategy. And I think the question for progressives should be, what is the most effective way of breaking the stranglehold of Wall Street and the billionaire class? And I would say, and as we have said before, earlier this year and last year, the most effective thing would have been for Bernie, when he lost the primaries, to have run as an independent through November, because we have seen in poll after poll Bernie Sanders being highly effective, in terms of the polar opposite that he provided to Trump, because Bernie Sanders is an alternative
vote
to both
Donald
the right-wing
the
demagoguery and an alternative to corporate democratic politics. And so ultimately, I would urge our listeners to imagine. I mean, by the time the primaries were ended, Sanders had enough recognition and polls in order to have made it into the debates if he had run as an independent. Imagine what an alternative to the real nausea that was created by the three presidential debates. If he had been there as an alternative to this political comedy, tragedy, circus that people had on offer. And I think that is the serious question people are grappling.
In the time we have, I want to focus the two of you wrote about whether or not to vote for the Green Party in this election. So, I haven't heard much from Joshua, and I want to get to you, Joshua. I want to at least make sure that Councilmember Sawant has. I want you to respond to his central claim that he made when we started, which was, what is your evidence that a vote for the Green Party is, as you say, strategic?
But I'd like to respond to some of the things that the councilor is saying as well.
As long as we're not looking backward, because I'm still trying to focus on this question.
Go ahead, Joshua. I hear quite a bit that, a vote for the Green Party sends a message to the establishment, to those in power. This is the most faulty of all the arguments. In 2012, 42% of the electorate just stayed home. Jill Stein got 0.36% of the electorate. If she were to get 1% and 43% stayed home, it's a rounding error in terms of the people who do not vote for one of the major parties. Now, the counselor says, well, Bernie Sanders should have stayed in and run as an independent. That would have split the progressive vote and given Trump the White House. Bernie Sanders never got traction with people of color other than millennial people of color. He never got traction with different constituencies that are part of the Democratic coalition. So what you would have seen is the Democratic vote fractured in half and Donald Trump becoming president with his 38%. This is not an effective strategy for anything. And again, we hear about that this is about rejecting the Democratic Party and very little defense of the Green Party, which, first of all, has adopted a scorched earth attack against Democrats. They are running a very dishonest campaign. You could go to Jill Stein's website. You'll see that claims that Barack Obama banned the morning after pill. She claims that the 2009 stimulus was overwhelmingly directed at tax cuts for the wealthy. That's false. And this is not constructive. I believe that you need to push Democrats from the left. And this kind of idea that you throw everything at the wall and see what sticks is an ineffective strategy. And it marks the ineffective nature of this party as a rule.
Councilmember Sawant, we're talking about what's effective, both of you are. What is your evidence that a Green Party vote would be, as you said, strategic, effective? You said you're all about strategy. This is not a protest vote to you.
Well, I don't mean that it's a strategy in the sense that I have any illusion that she's going to win.
Yes.
But what I'm saying is that if we are to look at what is going to really turn things around for the vast majority of America that is aching, that is suffering right now, and even at the time that it is the wealthiest in the very history of humanity. I think if we're seriously thinking about it, then we have to acknowledge, as does a lot of America, you know, 60% of Americans polled are saying that they want a new party because they have seen that decade after decade, their interests are being betrayed as long as you stay within this framework of Republicans and Democrats. And I think that you cannot get any real explanations of what is the way forward unless we, as long as we are stuck with this idea of looking at every presidential election in its own snapshot. I mean, Joshua mentioned the 2012 election where most electorates stayed home, but his analysis of why that happened is completely wrong. The reason the 2012 election had a much lower voter turnout than 2008, if you all recall, Bill, you know, Obama had a historic voter turnout of a Latino community, the Black community, women, and the LGBTQ community. The reason they turned out in such big numbers was because they had all pinned their hopes on yet another round of Democratic Party politicianeering. And this is not a debate about Obama's secret intentions. It's a question of whether if you run as the major party candidate, can you deliver on your promises? You cannot. And the reason the 2012 elections were so lackluster is because by then the electorate had become really disappointed and disenchanted at the corporate bailouts and the fact that there was mass deportations, and all of the promises that Obama had made were really in the waters.
Shama Sawant brought up a central question. Joshua, you have written that the Democrats and Republicans have separated, and the Democrats are markedly more progressive now in contrast to the past. What's your evidence of that?
Well, you can look at a wide variety of evidence. Political scientists use a metric called DW nominate, which actually measures the relative position of members of Congress according to their voting records. You can look at the Democratic electorate itself. According to Pew, about twice as many Democrats hold, quote, mostly or consistently liberal views in 2014 as they did in 1994. You can look at the Democratic platform. You can go back and look at the summaries of past platforms. There's really no question. You know, this is a fundamentally, this is a problem that I have with Stein, not the commissioner per se, but it's a fundamentally flawed argument that there's no difference or that Trump is just as bad as Clinton. This is what we're hearing from Jill Stein this cycle. It is a fundamentally dishonest analysis of American politics. And if people are interested, they can look at Jacob Hacker's book, Off Center, which marshals an enormous amount of evidence of this growing divide between the parties. It's asymmetric polarization. The Republicans have gone further to the right than the Democrats have to the left. But the reality is that, most progressives, most members of the progressive movement have dedicated themselves to pushing the Democratic Party to the left. We have marginalized the idea of Social Security reform. We have marginalized a lot of the right-wing economic claptrap that was ascendant in the 1990s. We worked hard to do that. And by saying that there's no difference, that we haven't made any progress, it's an insult to a lot of progressives who have done a lot of hard work on this. on these issues.
So Shama Sawant, this is an important question. He's making the case that you do have a choice. It's an important choice. The Democrats are getting progressive work done, and that's the place to put the power of your ballot. What's your evidence to the contrary?
Well, first of all, I think we should at least as far as my views and the views of the progressives that I represent, I think we should not build up straw men. I think we are all completely agreed that not only are Trump and Clinton not the same in any way.
That's not a straw man. Jill Stein regularly says that Hillary Clinton is more dangerous than, that may be more dangerous than Donald Trump. Folks can look that up. She says it regularly on the stump.
Okay, and the two of you are agreed that you don't want Trump in office.
Yes,
but worse than Clinton. But go on. Go on.
I'm saying that. It's Jill Stein who's saying that.
Okay, go on, Council Member.
I don't agree that they are the same, and I don't think that it's going to be a productive conversation if we just get stuck there, because that's not true. And we also don't agree that the Republicans and Democrats are the same. But the problem is that the Democratic Party has not really provided a progressive alternative away from the Wall Street agenda, away from right-wing demagoguery. And actually, the opposite has happened. They have, because they have this approach of developing, trying to develop a common ground with the right wing, rather than building power of their social base, rather than empowering social movements, which is the way we have operated in Seattle. Socialist alternative does not operate in some sort of stratosphere. The reason, the very reason we won our election was not because the Democratic Party establishment supported us, but they actually opposed us with every tool that they had in their toolbox. The reason we won was because we empowered ordinary working people, and we based ourselves in social movements like the Fight for 15, and we won those victories. And my point is that a vote for the most known left-wing alternative is an investment. It's an investment in, you know, building the prospects for an independent party of the 99%.
But haven't we had third-party votes? We've had Ralph Nader. We've had other. We had Ross Perot. Very different. But we've had third-party votes.
I
realize that. But the Green Party hasn't grown. It's
contracted.
It's got fewer
level.
Candidates.
And here's the thing.
I think that if we are going to seriously address the real concerns and the living standards of the vast majority of Americans, then it is incumbent upon us to think about this seriously and not make this about the Green Party. I am advocating that because supporting the Democrats or the Republicans has been a failed strategy. The strategy of lesser evilism has failed. And this is not a matter of fetish or opinion. These are facts. That is why I'm arguing that we need an independent party for the 99%.
Okay.
I don't imagine that it's going to happen in a day. What I'm saying is that investing in a left-wing alternative this year will provide us a little bit of a down payment for the future. But
okay,
I don't think that you can do that just by voting for Jill Stein. You have to really build social movements on the ground that are tied to building an independent party.
Okay, Joshua, what about just as a down payment? Jill Stein now, more later?
Well, when I've spoken with Kishama in the past, she's talked about what she's done at the local level, which is work very closely with social movements. It's an inside-outside strategy. I would like to see the Greens focusing on winning more offices in city councils, winning more school board offices, more local elected offices. This is not what they do. This is not what they do. You can invest in the Green Party. They're going to take your investment and spend it on getting ballot access for a quixotic presidential campaign in 2020. They're not going to build their party from the grassroots up. And I don't hear anything. You know, we are talking about the Green Party. We're debating the Green Party. We both wrote pieces about the Green Party. This is about the Green Party. The only
My piece was about why we need a left-wing alternative to the Democrats.
The only appeal of the Green Party is that they're not Democrats. Right. But that's not enough to invest your time and energy. If you go to a Green Party meeting, what are you going to see? You're not going to see any critique of the right. You're going to see a bunch of mostly white people proving to each other who is the most ideologically pure. That's what you're going to see. So it's not a down payment in any kind of coherent strategy to build a grassroots progressive movement. It is a waste of your vote. Whether Jill Stein gets 0.36% as she did in 2012, or whether she gets four times that much and, you know, whatever that is, 2%, 1.4%, it makes no difference. It makes no difference. They're contracting as a party at the local level, and they're putting all their resources into promoting Jill Stein, who is doing these scorched earth attacks on the Democrats, very dishonest attacks. And I don't see how that helps the progressive movement in any way, shape, or form.
Okay, last word, Kishama Samat.
Well, you know, Bernie Sanders ran as a socialist in America. America is like the belly of the capitalist beast. He ran as a socialist, and he called for a political revolution against the billionaire class. And
all, in the Democratic Party.
Yes, in the Democratic, which was the only mistake he made, really. It was one of the mistakes he made, not the only mistake. But I think what really stands out from that, and I think if we don't think about that, we're really missing what's going on today in America and are completely out of touch with reality, which is that this guy ran as an open socialist and called for a political revolution against the billionaire class in the United States of America. And the heartland of America rose in response to that call and said, yes, that is what we want. That is what we're talking about. So for Joshua to be talking about Green Party meetings is completely missing the point. Nobody's going to Green Party meetings that I'm talking about. I'm talking about all of those progressive Americans, who many of whom are actually, I know, are going to vote for Clinton. I completely understand that. I'm compassionate to that because they are trying to keep Trump out. But the reality is that they are not voting for Clinton out of any enthusiasm for her, because even they know that this is not working anymore, but right now I want to keep Trump out. And those are the people I am speaking to. And I know that most of your listeners, Bill, will fall into something along that spectrum where they're voting for Clinton, but they know something's wrong fundamentally in this two-party stranglehold. And I think if we are to seriously provide a way for the future, we have to break out of that. You know, and there will never be a good year in that sense, because the logic of lesser evilism runs ad nauseum, meaning if you accept lesser evilism, there is never a good year to break out of the two-party stranglehold. And that is why I'm saying that the first step is to break out of lesser evilism and understand that if we are really going to represent ordinary Americans who have lost so much ground and are dealing with poverty, racism, and misogyny, then it is really contemptuous towards them to say that there is absolutely no alternative. You have to just, you know, this is the best you can get. You either get a right-wing demagogue, or you get a candidate who is unrepentant in her positions towards Wall Street, in favor of Wall Street. I think that humanity, and I think that America, can do much better than that. That is why I have a message of hope based on reality, on strategy, and that is to break out of the two-party stranglehold.
Joshua, lesser of two evils has no exit.
The exit is to join the very large majority of progressives, especially young progressives, who are part of the movement, who are involved in pushing the Democratic Party further to the left. They've accomplished quite a bit. The lesson that Bernie Sanders showed us is how much impact you can have when you do that. So if you look at the Democratic Party's platform in 2016, the most progressive by far in the party's entire history, a lot of that is because Bernie Sanders did not choose to run as a Green Party or a third party candidate or an independent candidate, where he would be largely obscured by the major parties. He got involved in Democratic politics and he shoved the party to the left. And this is the alternative. You make the party so that it is not the lesser of two evils, but something that actually stands up for working people. One final point that I'll make is that Washington is a blue state. I voted for David Cobb in 2004 in California. David Cobb, unlike Jill Stein, ran a safe state strategy. Said if you're in a safe state, vote green. If you're in a swing state, vote Dem. This year, with Trump, I would like to see us run up the tally. I don't want to defeat Trump by 2 or 3 points. I want to crush him, because it's not about Trump. It's about the white ethno-nationalism that Trump represents. It's an ugly stain on this country. And if we can run up the scoreboard so that he is not beaten but crushed, that sends a signal to the smoother Trump that could come, that this kind of right populism that demonizes minority group, that demonizes immigrants and Muslims, is not acceptable in the United States. That far right, pseudo-fascist
you disagree on
stuff
strategy.
Is good for Europe.
You disagree on strategy, but I think we're agreeing on that final point. Yes,
we are agreeing that we want Trump to be crushed.
Yes.
I want Trump to be crushed too. But I think we would be failing the country if we didn't say that What is the strategy to stop future Trumps from being created? What is the strategy to really marginalize right-wing ideology? I don't agree
with
Joshua.
That's your bigger question.
Well, they're related, aren't they? I mean, if we are worried about Trump, shouldn't we be worried about worse things to come? And I think that it is a question of strategy. And I think the question is, has it worked and will it work in the future to simply try to push the Democratic Party to the left? Or should we build an independent left-wing progressive alternative to that? That's the question.
That's the question.
And I feel that based on the absolute mountains of evidence, I think that the former strategy of pushing the Democratic Party to the right hasn't worked. And it's not just me saying, more and more and more Americans are saying that is not working and we want an alternative. And I will say this too, if I saw any evidence that pushing the Democratic Party to the left worked, then I would do that because, as I said, it's not a fetish for me. And
it's a question of what's effective. And the Democratic Party of 2016 is demonstrably.
You know what, Joshua? You know who disagrees with you? Millions of Americans who voted for Bernie because they want an alternative. And I would. You can't say why people voted for people.
The bottom line is, you can look at the 2016 platform. You can compare it to the 2012 platform, the 2008 platform.
What I don't understand is now that Clinton has absolutely surged ahead past Trump, why in a state like Washington you wouldn't be calling for a vote for Stein?
Because
you know the majority of people are voting for...
I want to run up the margin.
Well,
I've
the tally is going to run up anyway because we know most progressives are going to vote for Clinton. And as I said, I'm compassionate to that. I want Trump to be crushed as well.
Right.
But my job is not to trail consciousness. My job as an activist, as a representative of working people, is to present a real way forward. And the real way forward is not going to come by simply supporting the Democratic Party. I just wanted to give one last question, which is a really good example, especially for Washington State, because activists here, you know, regular working people here fought for marriage equality. If you look at what the Democratic Party's position has been, what the position of the Clintons has been on marriage equality, you will see that for decades they actually made peace with the right wing. And in fact, Bill Clinton and Hillary Clinton supported him on this actively, did not just pass the Defend of Marriage Act, he bragged about it for his re-election campaign. And the reason we are here, that we have won marriage equality at the Supreme Court, is because ordinary activists mobilized and LGBTQ people came out, and then they came out on the streets and we mobilized and we fought back against the right wing and against the inaction of the Democratic Party, and ordinary people showed leadership. So ultimately, I think it's important to recognize that the message for working people, the message for everybody who's listening, and my appeal to everybody is that ultimately we have to figure out ways in which we can empower ourselves as working people, because history shows, and even the example of Roe v. Wade, which passed when the Supreme Court had majority Republican president nominees, it passed because working women stepped out on the streets and fought for it. Every example of history shows that unless we empower working people's movements and youth movements, no social change happens. And building an independent, progressive political base, a political vehicle for those mass movements, is part of that strategy.
And that was that. Obviously, there's always, when you do these things, there's always a lot that you wish that you had said. One thing that I would just point out is that we've learned a lot about partisanship in the last few years. Really, there's a growing body of new research about why people become partisans. And this idea that it's based on policies, you know, the Democrats are too close to Wall Street, and that's why everybody's furious at them. Basically, our partisan allegiances are an incoherent mishmash of what we inherit from our parents and what our social identity group tends to, the people around us tend to believe. And we don't base our allegiances on some sort of rational evaluations of what policies are, who's proposing the policies that are most likely to advance our own interests. And most of us tend not to be consistently ideological. Most Americans are ideologically incoherent. this idea that everybody's a progressive is a little bit odd. Anyway, I would like to thank again the crew of KUOW and, of course, Seattle City Councilor Kashama Sawant. Stay tuned. We'll take a quick break and then be right back with Caitlin Sweeney from the Progressive Change Campaign Committee. Back to the show. I'm still Joshua Holland, and I'm joined now by Caitlin Sweeney. She is the press secretary for the Progressive Change Campaign Committee, and you can follow their activities at boldprogressives.org. Caitlin, welcome to Politics and Reality Radio.
Thank you for having me.
Thank you for taking the time to talk to me. Hey, there was an important moment in the third presidential debate, and it got totally lost because in the middle of it, Donald Trump interjected with that "such a nasty woman" thing, right? So everybody was talking about "such a nasty woman," got all of the attention. But let me read the transcript of what surrounded that quote. So Chris Wallace, the moderator, said, and I quote, "At this point, Social Security and Medicare are going to run out. The trust funds are going to run out of money." And let me stop here to say that that's nonsense. "Will you, as president, entertain a grand bargain, a deal that includes both tax increases and benefit cuts, to try to save both programs?" And Clinton responded, I'm going to again read her quote, Well, Chris, I am on record as saying that we need to put more money into the Social Security Trust Fund. That's part of my commitment to raise taxes on the wealthy. My Social Security payroll contribution will go up, as will Donald's, assuming he can't figure out a way to get out of it. That's what he was talking about when he interjected and said, such a nasty woman. But what we want to do is to replenish the Social Security Trust Fund by making sure that we have sufficient resources that will come from either raising the cap and or finding other ways to get more money into it. I will not cut benefits. I want to enhance benefits for low-income workers and for women who have been disadvantaged by the current system. So, first of all, how significant is this? Like, I'm thinking in the 90s, the Clinton administration was always talking about their lockbox. During the entirety of Obama's presidency, there have been all sorts of talks about a grand bargain. Mm-hmm. Here we come to the 2016 election, right? And Clinton, who is known as a centrist, is saying, no, let's increase benefits and pay for it by raising the cap on payroll taxes.
Yeah, it was a very powerful moment. She's the first major party nominee that I can think of that has talked about in a debate in the situation about expanding Social Security benefits and not cutting them. And it is proof positive of how much the Democratic Party has shifted around these bold progressive ideas like expanding Social Security. Just a couple of years ago, Obama was still seeking that grand bargain with conservative suffrage. The prevailing wisdom, even among the Democratic Party, was the best that we could possibly do would be to not cut it. And expanding it was a pipe dream. You know, if you advocated for that, you weren't taken seriously in Washington. And it was amazing to see Hillary Clinton get up there and really push back against Chris Wallace's really right-wing framing, this idea that Social Security and Medicare are destined to go bankrupt, that there's nothing that can be done, that's just what's going to happen, and the best we can do is protect current retirees but by taking away from people down the road. And it was amazing to see her say, no, actually, we can, protect Social Security by not cutting it, by expanding it, by ensuring that seniors now and in the future can retire with dignity, because it's not an entitlement. It is an earned benefit that you get after a lifetime of hard work. It was a great moment, and like so many other things in this campaign, it was an utter shame that it got overshadowed by Trump.
Yeah, he sucks the air out of the room at mm-hmm. all times. It's really remarkable. So I think part of this, there are different things going on, right? First of all, there was the very real rise in inequality to the point where our elites could no longer ignore it. And you had things like Thomas Piketty's book became a bestseller. Our focus shifted. That was mm-hmm. one thing that happened. But there's also you folks at the Progressive Change Campaign Committee have been working on pushing the Democrats to the left, right? So
yes.
There is also this progressive movement. We, people like you and I, have also had a role in bringing about this change in focus from deficit reduction and getting a hold of the debt and talking about entitlement reform and lockboxes to saying, hey, actually, we have a majority of elderly people are getting by on their Social Security benefits. We need to increase this.
Mm-hmm.
What does it tell you about the kind of the influence of the progressive wing, the Sanders or Warren wing, if you will? I remember when we called it, what was his name? The Minnesota, you know what I'm talking about?
Wellstone.
Wellstone Democrats. I remember you used to call them Wellstone Democrats. Mm-hmm. So what does this tell you about the state of its position in the party?
It's not just Social Security. It's debt-free college. It's a $15 minimum wage. What's interesting is how much the party has shifted years of kind of progressive activism, really validating that these ideas aren't just popular with voters, you know, Democrats, Republicans, Independents, but that they are smart policy, that they can be done in a way that actually will help our economy in the long term. There's always this idea that, oh, if we do more projects and more programs for people, that it just adds to the deficit and we won't be able to pay for it. And it's like, well, you can increase taxes on the wealthy, which Clinton talked about. But often when you do these programs and you're investing in the middle class, you know, you are freeing up that capital. You're freeing up people to start small businesses and buy homes and contribute fully in the economy in a way that they can't now. I mean, if you're a young student and you graduate with $100,000 in debt, you are shackled in many ways. You're not going to be able to go out and buy a home and start a business a way that your parents' generation would have been able to, or your grandparents' generation. If you retire on Social Security benefits where the cost of living is only, you know, 0.3 increase every year, over time, you're not going to be able to you're going to be deciding between food and medication. So this is about saying that these policies are about making sure that people can live with dignity from the time they are born, you know, go to school and get a good education, be able to get a job that pays a living wage and an equal wage if you're a woman, you know, that your body is your own, that you can live and love who you want openly and not be discriminated against it, and that you get to retire with dignity. And that's what the Democratic Party stands for in such a profound way, and even more so now than it did only a few years ago.
Yeah, I mean, the shift has been fairly dramatic, even though I don't think all progressives have acknowledged it. I should tell you that one of the reasons I wanted to have you on this week is that I also have a debate about voting Green Party this year with the great Kashama Sawant, the Seattle city councilor. And she does not see any point in trying to move the Democratic Party further to the left, because she doesn't think that we've really made any progress. Let me shift gears a little bit. This week, Barack Obama came out in favor. This also was totally overshadowed by some dumb thing Donald Trump says, right? I mean, everything gets sucked up by his, which is good in some ways, because he's also not letting any of these, like, you know, the O'Keefe tapes are getting sucked up, all the wiki, he just sucks all the air out of the room. And he's so self-destructive that he's not drawing positive attention to himself. Anyway, Barack Obama came out in favor of a public option, a public health insurance option in all 50 states. What would that do to address the very real problems that have developed in the Affordable Care Act? I'm not talking about the nonsense that conservatives say about it, but we do see companies pulling out of the marketplaces. The premiums are not easily affordable for a lot of us.
Right. Well, the biggest thing it'll do is inject accountability and competition into the system. So right now, in many parts of the country, we have functionally a healthcare monopoly. You know, you have only one or two providers, and sometimes in case maybe three, but it's such a small number of actors that it's fairly easy for them to game the system by increasing premiums. I mean, let's be honest, all of these insurance companies are making record profits. They may not be making record profits on all of their various plans, but they are doing well for themselves. So the great thing about a public option is the government is, we see this in Medicare and in hospital payouts. It could hold private hospitals and insurance companies accountable by setting a ceiling on certain costs of things, setting a floor, and really providing a plan that people can buy into that, you know, isn't so cost prohibitive. I do agree with you. The fact that President Obama has come out for this it shows another way that it has shifted. And I understand this argument that the party isn't moving forward, or that the party isn't evolving, or that nothing can be done is quite ridiculous. When you look at 2 years ago, no, people were talking about tinkering around with student interest rates. Now, almost the entire party, from its standard bearer, Hillary Clinton, on down, is talking about debt-free college. You now have President Obama talking for the public option in a way he never has before. 33 Senate Democrats, including 8 members of the leadership, signed on to the Schumer, Sanders, Murray, Durbin, and Merkley resolution that we worked on. And then you have, you know, everyone kind of unified around expanding Social Security. So there's a lot of movement right now in the party toward these progressive ideas and a lot of oxygen in the room to get stuff done in the next administration.
If you're just tuning in, I'm speaking with Caitlin Sweeney from the Progressive Change Campaign Committee. Is that the best way to sell it as the public option? Is the politics of this good? Should we talk about letting people buy into Medicare through those exchanges? Is that the way it would be structured?
Well, I mean, we did the resolution a couple weeks ago, and it went from 5 co-signers to 33 in 2 days. And what that resolution was calling for was saying that we need a public option. But what that public option looks like was something to be determined in the next administration. Some people have floated, Medicare buy-in. Other ones say a public option that's structured like Medicare. Right now, I think it's just important of getting people rallying around this idea, having people campaigning on it actively so that we have that mandate after the election to really sit down and figure out how it would look like.
Go ahead.
I was going to say, also to note, I mean, in New Jersey, California, Minnesota, I mean, state governments right now are considering doing public option on the state level and, you know, kind of creating something to work for them that's, you know, tailor-made for their people. So it's not just people in Congress talking about it.
I have to say, I live in New York State, and I don't have a regular job, so I have a Affordable Care Act plan I bought through the Affordable Care Act from a private insurer, obviously, and they are pulling out this year. So next year I'm going to be faced with, I believe, 2 different companies, one which charges exorbitant rates and one which is awful. Excuse me.
Mm-hmm.
So that was an aside. Over the course of the 3 presidential debates and 1 vice presidential debate, there was precisely 1 question about climate change. And ironically, it was asked by Ken Bone, this internet sensation who also works at a coal-fired power plant.
Yes.
It's amazing how they choose what issues to focus on and which to ignore. I can't think of anything more important to us right now than addressing potentially catastrophic climate disruption. Another issue that got scant attention was also really huge, this $1 trillion student debt crisis. There were no questions about that, at least at the 3rd debate. I don't remember if there was one in the first 2.
No, she's been bringing it up. But it has
She's been bringing it up. Yeah. And what is her policy?
So she has something similar. She has a mix of things. So she talks about doing tuition-free for families up to $125,000, and then a mix of, I think it's like a potential work study and taxes from the state to do. So the goal is basically debt-free college for all, which would allow everyone to go to a state school and graduate with zero debt.
And, I mean, one of the things people I don't think understand is the importance of debt-free college when it comes to opportunities, when it comes to upward mobility. It allows you to take a job that might not pay well at first, but gives you better credentials moving forward, or an internship. It allows you the freedom to be entrepreneurial, to take a risk, to start a new business. You know, we're graduating kids that are saddled with this just crushing student debt. And it's a tragedy that we have to address, and it's so sad watching, you know, this dysfunctional political environment in Washington that can't bring itself, because of these ideological divides and partisan divides, they can't bring themselves so far to really take these issues seriously. Now, we always hear progressives talk about holding Democrats' feet to the fire, keeping them honest. This is important, but a lot of times I find that the progressive movement as a whole has not figured out exactly how to do that. What is the most effective way of doing it? What are your thoughts about this? I mean, we as we mentioned, this is what your group is largely about.
Right. Well, one of the things we're doing is pushing the Clinton administration, the campaign right now, future administration, not to get ahead of ourselves, to go.
Yeah, you should knock on wood.
I know, right? Having to turn around three times and spit. That we're pushing them to go bold right out of the gate, both in, you know, who she'll nominate in key positions in her administration and what her first 30 days or 100 days look like. So for Jeffrey College, I mean, the first 30 days or so of her administration is really going to set the tone for the level of boldness that we can expect to see from her in the next 4 years. And it really matters that the first fight be on something that truly inspires the public and also that sends a message to Republicans that have spent the last 8 years obstructing the Obama administration that Democrats are serious about, you know, passing big, bold, progressive ideas, that we're not going to be railroaded. For the PCCC, we really think that the debt-free college should be the top of her list. It's overwhelmingly popular with Democratic, Republican, and independent voters, and she's clearly asked for a mandate on this. I mean, she mentioned it in her convention speech. She's actively campaigned on it. She's mentioned it throughout the debate. 43 members of the Senate support it, including Chuck Schumer, who will likely be the next Senate Majority Leader. And it's a policy that galvanizes progressives. So we want to see that in her first 100 days, have that be her first big fight. We think it will show progressives that she's serious on other promises that she's made, but it will also inspire the public. And I think that's the key. I think if Democrats can inspire the public, rally them around to their cause, and use that bully pulpit in a way that Obama wasn't able to in his first term. He came in saying, signaling very on that he was going to compromise, which gave Republicans a ton of leverage because they knew if he's going to want to compromise with us, if we withhold our support, they're not going to budge. They're not going to pass something without us, which meant that they then just opposed everything. From the stimulus to Obamacare to any major policy position from Obama. So I think what Hillary needs to do right out the gate is say, no, I'm going to use the public support that I have for this. I'm going to use the bully pulpit. I'm going to bring you to the table. And if she does that, I think progressives will feel very confident in her administration.
One thing I find, there's a big difference between being an activist and an office holder, exercising power, right?
Mm-hmm.
Activists don't need to compromise. They can draw a line in the sand and say, this is just where we stand. And I sometimes see a real hostility toward lawmakers who do compromise among the kind of activist community, even though that's something you have to do to an extent to get things done. I think one of the truly difficult things, and we don't even have time to try to solve this today, is where do you draw the red lines? You know, how do you evaluate which compromises are worthy of accepting and which ones you should go to the ramparts over, which ones you should get outraged over and refuse to accept. I think this is something that, as a movement, progressives have to figure out. And I don't think it's easy. Caitlin, I believe we are about out of time. I want to thank you so much for taking the time to speak with me today. I really do appreciate it.
Sure, it's been a pleasure. Love to come on again, and, thanks for having me.
Let's keep in touch. That was Caitlin Sweeney. She's the press secretary for the Progressive Change Campaign Committee. Check out what they're doing at boldprogressives.org. I'd also like to thank Kashama Sawant, Matthew Martin, and Bill Ratke from The Record at KUOW 94.9 in Seattle for putting that debate together. You can follow me on Twitter at Joshua Hall. You can subscribe to the show on iTunes or Podbean. You can send a nasty email to the show at politicsandreality@gmail.com. Thanks to Digby and Crooks and Liars for letting me host the show at their respective joints. Of course, I want to thank all of you good people for tuning in. Have a terrific week. Everyone turns to